This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, a first-generation Ukrainian-American tells us her thoughts about ongoing violence in the eastern part of her country, violence that killed a loved one. But first, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie attracts attention everywhere he goes, and he's going lots of places these days. As a possible contender for the GOP nomination for president in 2016, he's trying to raise his national profile while stumping for other Republicans as chairman of the Republican Governors Association. Later, we will talk with reporters about his trip to Connecticut this week for Tom Foley's campaign. It's a trip he made in a New Jersey state-owned helicopter, by the way. But first, another Christie story with local ties. Families of the Sandy Hook shooting victims took a petition backed by 55,000 signatures to the governor asking for his support for a New Jersey bill that would have reduced the maximum size of gun magazines from 15 to 10. It's part of a nationwide gun control effort by the group Sandy Hook Promise. First, Christie wouldn't meet with the group, then he quickly vetoed the bill. In doing so, he used words like trivial and grandstanding and empty rhetoric to describe the bill and the effort by parents. One of those parents is Nicole Hockley. She's communications director for Sandy Hook Promise and the mother of Dylan, who was killed in his first grade class at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Nicole Hockley joins us in studio today. Nicole, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, could you tell us exactly what was in this bill? What would it have done?
The bill was a very clear-cut bill in that it would have just reduced the amount of bullets that could be held within a magazine for New Jersey residents from 15 bullets to 10 bullets. Very common sense, wasn't taking anything away from anyone, wasn't infringing on anyone's rights. It was just reducing the amount of bullets that a gun could put out at any one time.
How similar was this piece of legislation to other bills that have been passed or proposed in state houses around the country?
It is quite similar. The national recommendation is for a 10 bullets in a magazine. So that's what we help recommend. New York obviously has gone a little bit further than that with 7 bullets in a magazine. Connecticut's at 10. So these are reasonable magazine limits to suggest. It's not a bad bill in any sense.
Explain why reducing the size of the magazines, the number of bullets that anyone could shoot at any one time, is important to you and your organization.
It's incredibly important to us and very personal. The more bullets that can be shot out without reloading mean that there are less opportunities for heroes to emerge. We've seen, it only takes a few seconds for someone to intervene or interrupt. In Tucson, Arizona, we saw that, a jam occurred with 100 bullet drum, and people were allowed to escape. In Gabby Gifford's shooting, a grandmother was able to overcome the shooter when he was reloading. In our circumstance, Jesse Lewis, a child, was able to yell run. And at the same time, when some reloading issues were going on, children were able to escape from my son's classroom. 11 children are alive today because of that. And that makes a difference. Seconds make a difference. And if it's not infringing on a responsible gun owner's rights, then why not limit the amount of bullets? If it can save lives, it's worth pursuing.
What are the arguments that you are hearing, whether it's from supporters of gun rights, whether or not it's someone at the governor's office, if you ever got a chance to talk to anyone in the New Jersey governor's office? What are people saying about this particular bill that would make them not want to support it?
I have yet to hear a rational argument. In all honesty, I've heard people say, I need as many bullets as possible to protect myself. Well, if you need more than 10, I think you've got a significant issue anyway. People are saying that it wouldn't have made a difference. I can see no evidence pointing that it wouldn't have made a difference. All I have is a lot of evidence to say that it has made a difference in the past and could have made a difference here and in the future. I've yet to hear any other rational arguments.
We're talking today with Nicole Hockley. She's communications director for Sandy Hook Promise and the mother of Dylan, who was killed in his first grade class at Sandy Hook Elementary School. They brought a bill to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie for his support. He didn't meet with them. He vetoed the bill. And then later he used words like grandstanding to describe their efforts. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the interaction with the governor in just a moment. One of the things I did hear in the days after, and we all, of course, after this terrible event, had to learn a lot more and talk a lot more about guns than I think any of us wanted to. Mm-hmm. I talked to a few people who are gun rights advocates, including some people who had some fairly rational ideas about what they thought more gun control could look like. And I heard this a couple times, that the bigger the magazine size, the better chance there is of exactly what you said happened in Tucson, of a gun jamming. That indeed, bigger magazine sizes don't necessarily make for more efficient killing machines. They may make for less efficient killing machines. Is that an argument that you've heard?
I have heard that, and that's something that I support. When we were doing, you know, I speak from personal experience, obviously, but also Sandy Hook Promise, we've done a lot of research over the last year and a half to really learn about this issue, because you can't talk about something if you don't understand it. And education has been a big part of our the work that we've done over the last 18 months. And in talking to gun trainers, gun teachers, and gun groups, the ones that we've spoken to, I think 9 out of 10 of them have said that the most lethal aspect of a gun is the magazine. Because it can also, because it's the amount of bullets that it can get out, but also because it requires some skill in using and reloading and the jamming aspect, but also it allows for that chance for intervention if it's used in an act of violence. You know, Chris Christie, his mental health reforms, I absolutely applaud those. We absolutely need them. But proper gun safety and responsibility requires both the mental health aspect in order to prevent an act of violence from happening, but, you know, God forbid you're ever in that act of violence, if you can create a chance for someone to stop it, and if that's as simple as, you know, making an interruption when a magazine is being reloaded or if it jams, why wouldn't you want to take that chance and save some lives?
Do you think in the work that you've done and in the research that you've certainly done over the course of the last few years and the political movement that you've created, do you feel as though going after magazine sizes, for instance, is something that may work politically better than controlling the types of guns specifically that people can own and carry?
Well, like I said, the magazine is the most lethal part of the gun from our research. So we don't support bans of guns. We don't support assault weapon bans. We support sensible and responsible firearm ownership, so keeping guns safe and locked away, which will impact on accidental injuries and deaths, keeping them out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, such as felons and those that are mentally ill or have mental issues, mental health issues. But most certainly, magazines, that's something that can save lives. When you think about hunters, so many states have fair game laws in that their handgun or their rifle can only have 3 to 5 bullets or 7 bullets. That's so that the animal being hunted has a chance to escape. Why wouldn't we afford that same luxury to human life?
Talk a little bit about your attempt to get this bill through the New Jersey legislature and to get Governor Christie to sign it. When did you start working on this? And talk about how you tried to contact the governor's office and what that was like.
We started working on this bill over a year ago. And initially, we had a lot of great meetings with legislators. And when I say a great meeting, all of our meetings are very private because we don't shame legislators and we work very hard not to politicize issues. We just want to find that middle ground and make some change happen and honor our children and save others' lives. Last year, we had some great meetings, and that is also with meetings that people that agreed with us and also people that didn't agree with us, because you can still have a very good, respectful, courteous meeting and not agree with each other. But the fact that people would take the time to talk to us, that shows respect, that shows compassion. And that shows a willingness to learn and listen to a different point of view, which I think is very important, especially for political leaders. So we started this over a year ago. It didn't get through last year. But Senator Sweeney at that point said that he would revisit the bill. And he then, you know, he kept his word to us. He revisited it. He spoke to us further. And then he sponsored the bill. He helped bring that out. And we started contacting, you know, it got through both parts of the New Jersey Assembly. It had bipartisan support. It had good constituent support. I think it was about, I think the last research I saw said something like 70% of New Jersey constituents supported this vote. I could be wrong on that, but that was the research that I was aware of. And then it got to Christie's desk. We started contacting the governor's office towards the end of May, asking for a meeting with him. And if he didn't have time for a meeting, a phone call. And our, you know, we didn't get a response. We didn't get a response. It just kept happening. So we thought, okay, we're going to go down. We have this petition, 55,000 signatures. Around 10,000 of those were from New Jersey residents. We went down to Trenton. We saw Governor Christie walk into the office before us, so we knew he was present. We very politely and respectfully went to his office and said, you know, hey, we're here. Does the governor have a few, you know, 5 minutes spare for a private meeting? And we were told, we'll get back to you. And they had our phone numbers and everything. We went and we had our petitions. We had a little press event delivering the petitions. And then we left. And I was literally in the taxi going back to the train station when one of our contacts in the legislature contacted us, emailed me Christie's conditional veto. And it truly felt like a slap in the face. Mm. You know, it was tactless and insensitive. The fact that he didn't even have enough compassion to meet with us for even 5 minutes by phone or in person, to me felt cowardly. And he totally missed the point of the bill. Mental health reforms are important, but you need to do something about the gun safety as well. We did meet with him last summer, and it was a great meeting. He's a very charismatic man. But to not meet with us again, to not just hear our opinions, if he disagreed, that's fine, but at least have the courage to say, I disagree with you for these reasons, and not just spin the rhetoric of another group.
Well, and I think that an important piece of this story is, I mean, words matter, and I think that we all can agree at that. I mean, that's what I do every day, and we often talk here on the program about the words that people say and how they matter. And when you hear words like trivial or grandstanding or empty rhetoric to describe either the work that you're doing or the effort that you made to get this bill passed, what does that say to you?
It's insulting. It's insulting to the work that we do. It's insulting to the memories of our children and those that we lost that day. It's tactless and incredibly insensitive. And, you know, those certainly aren't qualities that you look for in political leaders. Have the courage to stand up and say, I disagree with you for these reasons. But to say it's grandstanding, the fact that we lost our children and we have taken this approach to take that heartbreak that we feel every single day and instead turn it into something positive for someone else and to save the lives of someone else, that's not grandstanding. Rhetoric based in experience and logic and education and rational facts is not rhetoric. Trivial. Life is not trivial. No one's life is trivial. And he was referring to the bill when he said trivial.
Yes.
But, you know, personally, that made it sound like my son's life was trivial. And my son's life was not trivial. Dylan was not trivial.
We're talking with Nicole Hockley, who's communications director for Sandy Hook Promise, about their attempt to get a bill on magazine size through the New Jersey state legislature and then to the desk of Governor Chris Christie, who then vetoed the bill. Coming up later, we're going to be talking about Chris Christie's visit earlier this week to stump for Tom Foley and to raise money for him. What do you think, now that you've had this experience with the governor, about the fact that he is heading up a Republican Governors Association, flying around the country, and coming into your home state about an hour from where you live, about an hour from where this happened, and raising money for a guy who wants to be the next governor of this state?
Well, Christie's doing his job, and you know, I can respect that because we all have our things that we want to do and the jobs that we want to stand for and do something about. I thought it was ironic that he did a town hall right near a playground for one of the slain teachers from Sandy Hook Elementary School. But, you know, I disagree with him on what he's doing and who he's supporting, but that's my own personal opinion. It does smack of a little bit of irony, I suppose, that he, you know, I've heard from his constituents, some New Jersey constituents, a very small minority, saying, you know, you have no right to come down to from Connecticut to New Jersey and talk to us about our laws. Well, why does Governor Christie have any right then to come up and lobby for a different governor up here? You know, our states don't have walls around them. We're easily commutable. We're neighbors. So it's ironic, but, you know, he's got to do what he's got to do. And I and Sandy Hook Promise we're going to continue to do what we've got to do.
You know, states don't have walls around them, but as we find over and over again, sometimes the governors of the states in this area are at odds, not just between New Jersey and Connecticut, but all throughout our region. It seems as though there's sniping amongst the governors. It made me think, though, of something you said earlier about just wanting to sit down and talk with someone who doesn't agree with you. I had a, you know, I have regular conversations with Governor Malloy, and as you well know, he very quickly after the shooting supported some very strict gun control measures here in the state that I understand that your group supports. But I talked to him a few times about how he had an unwillingness to sit down and talk with some of the gun manufacturers in the state, people who make guns here. And one of the things he told me is, you know, I know what they're going to say. I know what the gun lobby is going to say. I know what gun makers are going to say. I don't really need to sit down and negotiate with them and talk with them. And I heard him say that. And, you know, I hear the story about Chris Christie not wanting to sit down with you folks and hear your point of view. And I guess I just wonder if we just sat and rationally talked with more people who we don't agree with, if we might get closer to finding some answers for some of the things. I know some of the answers you're looking for. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. If this continues to be a fight where people aren't listening to each other and where people are just taking sides, then at the end of the day, no one wins. It requires thoughtful conversation. It requires listening to each other. And that means your own point of view as well as listening to others' point of view. And you might not agree at the end of the day, but that's okay. But you are one step closer to finding common ground. And if that common ground can make the difference for the future of our kids or for the safety of our country, that's worth continuing to talk about. And that's our whole approach at Sandy Hook Promise, and that's the way we're going to stay going forward. You're not going to see us at rallies or political activity in that way. We want conversation because that's the way to find solutions.
Has this work that you've been doing with Sandy Hook Promise, has it helped you in your recovery?
This is, that's a really big question. This is my therapy in many respects because this is my way of keeping my son's memory alive, doing something for his legacy. He was six when he died. But it's at the end of the day, it still is awful because no matter what I do, no matter what Sandy Hook Promise does, no matter how many lives we save, he's still gone. And that's never going to change. And that's hard to, it's impossible to accept. But at least his death won't be meaningless. At least it'll stand for something. And if that means that I can look at another kid in the sidewalk and say, you know, you might be alive today because of my son and the work that Sandy Hook Promise has done in his memory and in the memories of others, then that will give me some peace of mind.
Nicole Hockley is Communications Director for Sandy Hook Promise, and she's the mother of Dylan, who was killed in his first grade class at Sandy Hook Elementary School back in December of 2012. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us, and I haven't gotten a chance to sit down and talk with you in person. I'm very sorry for your loss, and thank you again for your time today.
Thank you, John.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He was in our state earlier this week raising money for Tom Foley, who's running for governor. We're going to talk with a reporter in Connecticut who's been covering this and a reporter from New Jersey who regularly covers Governor Christie. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Coming up, a Ukrainian-American woman talks about the violence in eastern Ukraine that killed a family member and where she sees her home country headed. But now we're talking about the Chris Christie impact on Connecticut. As we just heard, he offended parents of Sandy Hook shooting victims by not meeting with them, by vetoing a gun control bill they support, and by calling their effort trivial. Just days later, he was on the road again in his role as chairman of the Republican Governors Association, this time to Greenwich, Connecticut, about an hour from Sandy Hook, to raise funds for Republican candidate for Governor Tom Foley. To get here, he didn't take the frequently clogged highway that links our states, nor did he go across the bridge that his staff famously clogged in the political payback scheme. Instead, he took a New Jersey state-owned helicopter. The trip and the method of the trip have drawn more controversy to an already controversial figure. Here to talk about Chris Christie's stumping in Connecticut and around the country is Mary O'Leary. She's a reporter and topics editor for the New Haven Register who covered the visit to Greenwich. Mary, welcome back to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John. Nice to be here.
And also with us on the line is Matt Arco, who's a reporter covering Governor Christie for the Star-Ledger and NJ.com. Matt, welcome to the show. Well, let me just click the right button. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
First of all, Mary, let me ask you about this visit to Connecticut that Chris Christie made. It was a fundraiser for Tom Foley. You were there. What was it like?
Well, there was. I think there were more people from the press and the media getting into the Glory Days Diner, a very popular diner, I guess, on Main Street in Greenwich. But Mr. Christie, Mr. Foley came. Talked to some of the people there who were, I mean, there were obviously Republicans supporting him. And he made a pitch. Most of the questions were about his veto of the expansion of the gun bill in New Jersey. And I think most of the news reports actually were more about the protesters around that. We're around 200 people, a bigger crowd, I'd say, than were in the diner.
So a lot of protesters and then some counter-protesters protesting the protesters. So it turned into, in some ways, an event about guns or gun control. Any sense, Mary, as someone who covers Tom Foley in his bid for governor, how all this sat with the candidate?
Mr. Foley tried not to, he made a good effort not to comment at all on Governor Christie's decision around the guns. Tried to steer the conversation back to the economics in Connecticut, and it wasn't too successful, I don't think, in most of the interviews I heard that day. And so both went off to fundraisers. The Republican Governors Association was one of the fundraisers, and one specifically for the Republican Party here. And how successful they are or were, we don't know yet. But it's quite costly to actually be invited there. $10,000 was some of the donations, at least $1,000.
$10,000 is nothing in Greenwich. That's a Tuesday night, right? But still, it probably raised a lot of money for the Republican Governors Association. And I would assume for Tom Foley's effort to unseat Dan Malloy. Let me turn to Matt Arco and talk a little bit about the gun bill that we were just talking about before we get into some of the other things that Governor Christie has been doing as he jets around the nation for the Republican Governors Association. We had Nicole Hockley on from Sandy Hook talking about the bill that Chris Christie vetoed. Could you tell us a bit more about it, Matt? I mean, how big an issue was this in the state?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I heard what Nicole had to say. And, you know, obviously the bill had support in the state. I mean, New Jersey is a blue state, so it's something that I know that the polls support the legislation here. And it's something I guess as a whole the folks support. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know that we've seen quite the amount of protests that we saw, you know, Jersey reporters saw when we went to Connecticut. We just haven't kind of seen that kind of outpouring of support for that sort of or for that proposal or for any sort of these gun reforms than we saw then. I mean, there's obviously local groups that here that are consistently in the state house to support that bill and to support other bills. In the past couple of years, they have kind of come to move through the legislature. But, you know, certainly for the Jersey Press Corps, when we all went up to Connecticut, we were surprised by the amount of folks that came over. And there were some Jersey folks that traveled up to Connecticut with us to protest the event as well.
Can you talk about your analysis, Matt, of the political calculation, perhaps, that Chris Christie made in vetoing this particular bill? It seems as though people in New Jersey widely supported it, at least from what we've read about poll numbers. It seems as though the legislature supported it, at least in some sort of a bipartisan manner. I guess one way of me asking this is, if Chris Christie wasn't potentially running for president sometime soon, is this the sort of thing that a Republican governor in a northeastern state would normally just say, yeah, I'll sign that?
Well, that's certainly the argument of Democrats in the state that say that the governor is just obviously, you know, working towards his national ambitions. I mean, it's not really a secret in Trenton or in the state of New Jersey that Christie is most likely eyeing a presidential run. So more or less a lot of what he does and how he signs particular legislation or just how he responds to any particular legislation has always looked kind of through that prism. So that's certainly the Democratic line, as we move forward here. You know, I don't want to say whether or not he would have signed the bill if talk of a 2016 presidential bid was or was not on the table, but it's certainly something that's being you know, tossed around the Jersey State House.
Do you think that this decision ends up in some ways hurting him politically in New Jersey? I mean, is there backlash there, or is it more a type of a national backlash based on exactly the story we just heard from the Sandy Hook parents, the fact that those who support gun control in the country are now seeing Chris Christie as someone that they can, certainly target as a leading person moving over to the side of gun rights advocates?
Well, candidly, I think I'd be surprised if it really hurts him. I mean, folks that are not on the same page with Christie on this issue probably aren't on the same page with Governor Christie on other issues. They're probably not his supporters. I mean, but at the same time, he's a governor of a Republican governor of a blue state who was reelected by a significant margin. And as recent as just yesterday, when he was in Aspen talking with having a conversation with other Republican governors, he made the point to say, look, folks support me even though they don't agree with me on every issue. And that's clearly the case, just by default of the last election when he was, reelected by a significant margin.
We're talking with Matt Arko. He's a reporter covering Governor Chris Christie for the Star-Ledger and also NJ.com. Mary O'Leary is here. She's a reporter and topics editor for the New Haven Register. Of course, one of the things that comes out of this that's so interesting to us is this kind of feud between Governor Dana Malloy and Governor Christie. Let's listen to the two of them.
People in the state have gotten to see Governor Malloy's policies up close now for 4 years. It was only a theory 4 years ago. Now they've gotten to live underneath the highest tax increase in Connecticut's history and just the way that jobs have been driven out of this state.
We're funding our obligations. They're defunding their obligations. They've been downgraded 6 times. That's not happened to Connecticut. We are properly investing in the future.
So that was Chris Christie and Dan Malloy both speaking to WTNH in Greenwich on Monday after Chris Christie's trip to the state working on behalf of Tom Foley. What do you, as someone, Mary, who covers state politics, make of this ongoing feud that somehow or other Chris Christie, a national political figure, Dan Malloy, certainly a prominent political figure in Democratic circles, maybe making more of a name for himself nationally with lots of television appearances, that they have this ongoing verbal sparring?
Well, apparently it started right away in February 2011 when Governor Malloy proposed his first biennial budget. And he made a point of protecting social services, protecting aid to the towns. He did enact a very big tax increase. So immediately, looking at the record, it was Governor Christie who was the first one to sort of fire the first shot, criticizing him and saying that he was going to welcome all the businesses that were going to come over the border from Connecticut. So it sort of started there and has continued. It's kind of really sort of odd that I think Mr. Christie is being held up as a fiscal giant that should be the model for Connecticut, given that he just $800 million, I think he was off on his budget this year and has just put off $2.4 billion in paying down pensions. So the feud goes on with both of them back and forth, and I don't see it's going to end.
Well, Matt, you cover Governor Christie every day and also what happens in New Jersey with the budget, et cetera. When Dan Malloy makes criticisms of Governor Christie, are some of them rightful? Should some of them stick?
Well, they're the same exact criticisms that we're hearing from Democratic governors kind of across the nation. I mean, when Christie was down in Nashville for the National Governors Association, these are the same sort of criticisms that we heard. And I suspect that even, years down the line, in the event that there is a Republican primary for the White House, we'll probably hear the same criticisms, maybe even possibly from other Republicans. I mean, the New Jersey's economy is facing some serious issues. And on paper, there are these downgrades that the governor has kind of brushed off. So it's fair game for these other folks running for office, particularly Democrats, to, when the governor is coming as chairman of the RGA to their state, to try to give Christie a black eye on those issues. And he did not make the full pension payment like he had, pretty much signed into law and worked with the Democratic legislature to kind of reverse the course of how they were going to be funding the pension payment. So these are things that has absolutely happened in the past couple of weeks and will be, fair game for other folks to point out.
Also seemingly fair game is his role with the RGA, the fact that he is doing all of this work out of state. I guess two questions for you, Matt. One is, how much impact do you think he's having on the ground in some of these other states? He's a very controversial figure. People end up talking more about him sometimes than the candidate who he's stumping for. His particular brand of politics doesn't play in all sorts of places where Republicans hold a little bit more control. How has that actually worked, him being a spokesperson for the RGA?
Well, you know, it'll be interesting down the line to see how that works with voters, how voters kind of perceive that different sort of attitude. But I can tell you just from following him in places like New Hampshire and Iowa, you know, when he's walking up to these diners, and obviously they know that Christie's coming and that their gubernatorial candidate is coming to the restaurant or the diner or wherever the stop is. So, you know, these folks have a good idea of what they're in store for. But when Christie's, you know, Governor Christie is coming into these things, I can tell you just being at a few of them, you know, folks are a lot more interested to meet Governor Christie, shake hands with him, get an autograph, have a picture taken with him than they are within the actual candidate he's stumping for. So, you know, I don't know if that means it's just because, you know, maybe the local folks already have a good sense of who their current governor is or governor hopeful is. But Christie certainly steals some of the thunder when he goes to these events, just in terms of, you know, the folks that have gathered there.
Mary, from your experience in Greenwich, does that sound about right as you talk to people who are maybe likely Republican supporters? I mean, are they making more a big deal of Chris Christie coming than Tom Foley actually being their candidate?
Well, definitely at the diner, it was Mr. Foley had very little to say and basically was asked some questions at the end. But the entire focus, I think, of the press corps was on Mr. Christie.
And I'm sure it will be wherever he is. Do you get a sense, Mary, that support like this from outside the state, whether it's Chris Christie or anyone else, will do something to raise the awareness of Tom Foley after he narrowly lost to Dan Malloy in the last election cycle? He certainly has more name recognition than he did before, but it's fair to say that even in recent polling, he doesn't have the name recognition that some other statewide candidates might have or that he might like to have. Do you think that people coming from the outside is actually a boon to him, something that will help?
You know, I really don't think so. I think because this particular trip was so controversial that I think it really took the whole focus off the election, essentially, and put it on gun reform, gun laws. So I'm not sure that it really and there's been complaints by the other gubernatorial Republican candidate, Mr. McKinney, about his own party, essentially pretty much, I think, taking a stand in favor of Mr. Foley, who was nominated at the convention, but he would like them to wait for Republicans to vote in the primary on August 12th.
And, of course, John McKinney, Sandy Hook, Newtown, is in his district. He very strongly came out in support of some of the gun control measures that were passed into law in Connecticut, something that many Republicans in the state don't like, but tends to be something that goes more in favor of the way Connecticut might vote or might poll on an issue like gun control.
That's true. And obviously, there are distinct positions between the men on this. But Mr. Foley, Mr. McKinney has been very clear. He obviously was supportive of the gun reform law. Mr. Foley has been less forthcoming. He's really emphasized the need for mental health programs. But you can't pin him down on exactly which portions of the law that he disagrees with.
Matt, a last question for you. You know, obviously, we think a lot about Chris Christie in terms of whether or not he's going to run for president in 2016. We saw this story come out that he took a helicopter, a New Jersey state-owned helicopter, and even the reporters here in Connecticut made some light of the fact that he skipped the bridge that he famously clogged for a drive up here. Do stories like that, do the ongoing lingering effects of this bridge gate that happened with him, does it really take him out of the running as a national political figure, or is he still someone who has the ability to rally enough people to his side to be someone who could be in play?
If you're looking strictly at the polls, the answer is, you know, he, as far as things go right now, that he's sort of survived it. I mean, before everything happened with the bridge scandal, there were polls out there in certain states that showed him kind of ahead of Hillary Clinton in a potential 2016 matchup. He hasn't kind of rebounded from those poll numbers, but the sort of downward fall has certainly stemmed. I mean, it's been plugged. So, you know, it certainly suggests that he's kind of survived that, if you want to use that terminology, in the sense of, you know, we don't know what's going to be coming out in the next few weeks, months, or what have you. But, you know, as far as things go now, it seems like that's sort of kind of getting a little bit closer to the back burner. And I mean, just from the fact that, you know, as RGA chairman, he's going to be going out kind of boasting about the fact that he's helped raise this record amount. You know, other Republican candidates certainly want him to campaign in their states. So I'd have a hard time believing that it's sort of taking him out of the running at this point.
Matt Arco has one of the really fun jobs in political coverage. He covers Governor Chris Christie for the Star-Ledger and for NJ.com. Matt, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim.
Also, thanks to Mary O'Leary. She's a reporter and topics editor for the New Haven Register. Thank you, Mary.
Nice to be here, John.
Coming up next, a Ukrainian-American woman talks about the violence in eastern Ukraine that killed a family member and where she sees her country headed. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, the 2012 race for Connecticut's 5th Congressional District seat was filled with a lot of campaign-related shenanigans, but the person who came out on top was Elizabeth Esty. She's now running for re-election this year in the Fighting 5th, and she'll join us for the next in our Where We Vote series. You can join the conversation coming up on the next Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking with Roxolana Luchkin. She's a first-generation Ukrainian-American who has family living in Ukraine. Her cousin was recently shot to death in the war-torn eastern section of the country. She's organizing a benefit, which will take place in New York City this Sunday, to raise awareness and money for injured soldiers in Ukraine. And it's raising money for three specific men. Of course, Ukraine has been in the top of the news after the downing of a Malaysian airliner in the last week. And so we wanted to have Roxolana in to talk a bit about her story and find out a bit about where she thinks her home country is headed. Roxolana joins us in studio. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here. I appreciate it.
I'm wondering first if you can tell us the story of your cousin and what he was doing in eastern Ukraine when he was killed.
Yes. My cousin, Yevhen Wojciechowski, he was a commander in the military there in the Ukrainian army. And he was there fighting for the cause for free Ukraine to help. I was saying the pro Russian separatists there, but these days I actually call them terrorists. And so he was fighting against them, trying to free that region from them. And on July 7th at 5 a.m. in the morning, his troop was attacked and he was shot to death. And ironically, this happened in a village called Shastya, which means luck in Ukrainian.
Mm.
And, I didn't know what was going on over there, and I just, through sort of the grapevine, heard that perhaps my cousin might have been killed. But there's so much hearsay going on. There's so much news coming out. I thought to myself, this can't be true. This can't be true. I heard this, but I didn't think it was true. The next morning, I got an email from my other cousin saying it is indeed our cousin Yevhen who was killed. And following that, I was sent a link to his obituary, which included a video of his funeral procession in Smila, the town where he was living. The procession was huge. Thousands and thousands of people were there to honor him. And it was surreal because here I am in America and I'm looking at what's going on in Ukraine and I see thousands of people and my uncle and my aunt and my cousin Pavlo, his younger brother, at the casket, over the casket. It was just really surreal and just very, very emotional too, and hard because I'm here. And what can I do? What can I do to help? Is there anything I can do? So I've been working on a fundraiser, and ironically, I was working on this fundraiser before this happened. It was back when things started to happen in November. One of my friends from New York City. I used to live in New York City for a long time. I was a yoga teacher there, and one of my friends, Annalise, she contacted me. She's not Ukrainian, but she was concerned and wanted to know what was happening, how my family was over there. And at the time, my family was okay, but I Skype with my uncle Vitaly quite a lot, and I told her that I'd been talking to him, and he sounded very distressed about what's going on, and we were very worried. And she said, "Well, what can we do? Maybe we can do a benefit." And I thought, "Wow, that's a great idea." And I got my head sort of my brain thinking, and I'd done fundraisers a number of times in New York City before. I used to raise awareness on the subject of trafficking of Eastern European women. A while ago, when it wasn't big news, people didn't really know about it. People used to think that these women were prostitutes, where indeed they were trafficked. So I was wanting to raise awareness about that. So in any case, I did several fundraisers. So I thought, I've done this before, I can do it. But I'm in Connecticut, I'm no longer in New York City. So I reached out to my friend Anya Spook, and she's a real big activist and lives in Brooklyn. And so together we started to pull this together. We enlisted the help of my friend Christina Sawicki, who's an amazing designer who did all of our artwork for nothing, put her heart into it. And then just other women, Ukrainian Americans, just regular Americans who've become interested in the cause. And it's really come together quite nicely, and we're excited. Sunday is the event.
Sunday is the event, and before we run low on time, we'll make sure that we give some information if you want to learn more about this benefit. As we talk with Roxolana Luchkin, a first-generation Ukrainian-American whose family living in Ukraine, we read an essay about her story at the World Affairs Council of Connecticut blog, ctwac.org, and so we wanted to talk about her story. You said you didn't know the extent of how bad things were until you heard from your family and they were distressed. We've been, even on our air, talking with people about this unfolding situation. And depending, frankly, on how much Americans want to pay attention to the situation in Ukraine, it's something that they could open up the papers and look at or avoid in many ways. The downing of this Malaysian flight by these pro-Russian separatists, people you're calling terrorists now, and I don't think it's entirely clear where the missile was fired from, it brought down a passenger plane, killed hundreds and hundreds of people. Now this has focused the world's attention on this place, and I guess I'm wondering how you've been thinking about it differently or maybe not differently in this last week, as so much attention has been in the same place that you and your family have been thinking about so much recently.
Well, I wanted to just say that I did know things were very bad there. I just didn't know that my direct family was going to be affected.
Yes.
So that's where that shock sort of came in. But I have been keeping up with what's been going on and speaking with a lot of contacts there and was aware that things were really quite bad. It's horrible, this tragedy, the Malaysian Airlines. It's just unbelievable, the loss of so many lives. It does bring the situation to the forefront even more, but it saddens me greatly that this is what it has taken to bring this out even more into the public eye and to have people really be doing something about it. And so that saddens me, but I just hope that these lives were not lost in vain and that this will propel more action to help Ukraine.
Just the other day, the Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk announced his resignation, and it creates a little bit more uncertainty in the nation. And I guess one of the questions that we've had over and over again is, what is the Ukraine that your cousin was fighting for? Is it clear in your mind what the country is or should be? Because it's clearly one of the huge questions right now. Can there be a stable government in Kiev? Is the country as constituted one country, or is it two countries, a pro-Russian country and a pro-Ukrainian country? How do you view all of that?
Well, I know it appears kind of haphazard what's going on with the government right now and the resignation of Yatsenyuk. And his resignation actually still has to be accepted by the government in order for that to really take place. But it's a strategic maneuver on his part. It's a calculated maneuver, because what's going to happen is, after his resignation, it'll propel the elections to take place sooner. And with the new elections, we hope to get more people into the government that are more patriotic. And in turn, they will then support more military support for Ukraine, more funding. And hopefully that will help stop the problems that are there now, hopefully fund the military and get rid of the terrorists and create a more stable environment there. And I believe that with this, things will really help. I think we've come a long way in Ukraine. It has been a country in the past with a lot of corruption, definitely a lot of corruption. But I think people like Yatsenyuk, who are good people, who are not corrupt, and very bright and westernized. He's known as a very capable economist. I think we need more people like him in the government there. So I do see it going in the right direction. But Ukraine, again, needs a lot of help. They do. They're not known for their military strength. They're fighting against Russia, this huge military power. It's just they can't do it on their own.
Well, what do you think that they need from the rest of the world, from the rest of the West? As you said, perhaps this downed airliner has galvanized in some ways the rest of Europe to think about this in a different way, to consider harsher sanctions against Russia, to consider whether or not they wanted to trade with Russia, whether or not they wanted to get their gas and their oil from Russia in the same way that they have. What do you think the rest of the world needs to do to come to Ukraine's aid?
I think all those things that you said are very important. I think we need to look both at the U.S. as well as the European countries. Geographically, it's very strategic for them to be involved. Economically, it's very strategic for them to be involved. I think the gas pipeline is an important subject. Definitely, we need to look at that. Europe needs to look for alternative resources. We need to look at more and more sanctions. We need to look at trade. We need to look at the military, the purchases with France and Russia.
France selling military aircraft to Russia just recently.
Exactly. There's been protests about that everywhere, and that's huge. We need to look at why is that happening. And I do believe that we, as much as I am against fighting and war, I do believe strongly that Ukraine does need military support. I was reading about the Pentagon offering support in terms of training, but we need more assistance. And there are groups trying to raise money. There's another organization called IFAC that's raising money for tourniquets, bulletproof vests, medical assistance, things like that. We need more of that. We need more help. We need training and more help for the military. I do believe that. And I think that Europe really needs to step up to the plate in that measure, and hopefully the U.S. too.
We just have a little bit of time left. Are you hopeful that this will turn out in a good way for Ukraine? Do you feel as though your country will be able to withstand what's happening right now?
I am hopeful. It has to. I am very hopeful. Going back to my family, in speaking to my uncle, I Skype with him regularly. He lived through this. He was there. He lived through the Soviet Union. My parents escaped from the Soviet Union. We can't go back. We cannot go back there. We can't. I am positive that the world is going to help Ukraine, and I'm positive that there will be a good future. There are lots of strong people working on this, and there is so much support by the Ukrainian community, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. Ukrainians are all over the world. They are passionate, wonderful, strong people, and we're not going to give up.
If you could, in just the last 30 seconds or so, could you let people know, in case they're interested in this event that you're putting together in New York City, where would they find information?
Sure. It's a yoga benefit, and it is going to be a yoga class in New York City at the Ukrainian Institute of America on 79th Street and 5th Avenue. It's pretty much across from the Metropolitan Museum. It's at 4 o'clock. For more information on that, you can email us at yogaforukraine@gmail.com. You can also Google the Ukrainian Institute, and it's listed under their events. Or you can look at our donation page by going to mycaring.com and searching on Yoga for Ukraine. So again, that's www.mycaring.com and then search Yoga for Ukraine.
And we also put information out on our Twitter account, too, at Where We Live. Roxolana Luchkin, thank you so much for joining us. I'm very sorry for your family's loss, and thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
Our program today is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks so much for joining us today and all this week on Where We Live. We'll be back on Monday. Please have a great weekend.